Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're beginning our Monday, as we usually do, with the political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken, we are in our member drive, so you have to make this an especially good junkie episode. Can you deliver? That's your mission.
I don't think so. No, yes, I will try my hardest. I'm sorry.
What is that?
Yeah, I meant to say yes. Absolutely. But you know something? Every week with you is absolutely the best.
It just
show
gets
ever
better and better.
Because the news does our work for us.
You're just, yes, that's right. I was going to say you're such a kiss-up, but then you went to that news thing. Big news this morning about opening the embassy in Jerusalem. You know, other presidents have talked about this, Ken. Why was this a priority, do you think, for President Trump?
Donald Trump has a thing about Israel. I don't think he has things about Jews as much as he has for Israel. And I think he thinks that he feels that Israel is obviously a very important ally, also in a bulwark against Iranian expansionism and Palestinian extremism and things like that. And the U.S. evangelical community has also always seen Israel as the place where perhaps the return of Jesus Christ or whatever, but Israel has always been a special part of the evangelical community, and Donald Trump has certainly taken up that cause from the beginning of his campaign.
You mentioned Iran. Since we spoke last Monday, the president pulled out of the Iranian nuclear deal, also scheduled this summit with the leader of North Korea. I'll get to that in just a minute. The reaction in Europe has been pretty interesting here. For a while, it sounded like French President Macron was going to hold out the chance that, oh, maybe we can renegotiate something. Now it sounds like Europe is coalescing around the idea that they can keep this going themselves and that Iran is willing to keep it going with the Europeans. Political upside, downside to that.
Maybe, maybe not, because you're also hearing from the hardliners, like the people who, you know, who are led by the Ayatollah in Iran, who've said that since the Americans cannot be trusted, that they are treacherous, in the words of the Ayatollah, that maybe we don't have to abide by this law either, since it's been abrogated, not law, but the deal, since it's been abrogated by Donald Trump. And so maybe the re-enrichment program of our uranium in Iran, that program may begin again. So there's, you know, as much as Donald Trump wanted out of this deal because he felt it was not good, it was just a bad deal, the hardliners in Iran felt the same way. And it put people like Macron and May and Merkel and other U.S. allies in Western Europe at a disadvantage. As you point out, Macron came to the U.S., gave a speech before Congress, said this is very, very important. It's working so far. Even Mike Pompeo, the new Secretary of State, has said in testimony that he sees no evidence that Iran has abrogated any part of the deal, that they're keeping their word, and which is complete opposite of what the president has been arguing from the beginning since the campaign.
How much is it just about the fact that it was one of President Obama's chief foreign policy accomplishments? I mean,
you can't dismiss that, because it seems like almost everything you were talking about, foreign policy, climate change, immigration, all these things that were the signature achievements, thought to be the signature achievements of the Obama administration, has been undone one by one by the Trump administration. And you have to think that it's not, look, obviously Trump and Obama come from politics from two different sides, but it almost seems like since every mention, everything that the president does, it seems to be mentioned, well, the misguided efforts of the previous administration, and he'll talk about Obama, he'll talk about Hillary Clinton. You have to think that a good portion of what he's doing and why he's doing it is because just to undo what President Obama had accomplished.
I follow Katty Kay of the BBC on Twitter, and she's tweeting, Iran and Jerusalem, campaign promises. Jobs in China, not a campaign promise. You know what she's talking
Isn't
about, Ken?
Something.
It is.
Isn't that something? Now, this is obviously, look, the president, one of his big deals, big issues during the campaign was the economic manipulation by China and the way it uses its power to to, you know, drive up American prices. And so the president wanted to have retribution by putting sanctions on China, which, of course, was a president that was a campaign promise that he completed. But then when he obviously needs China's help in his dealings with North Korea, he suddenly realizes that this company, ZTE, this telecommunications company in China, could lose tens of thousands of jobs. The president completely switches and says, look, I don't want to be responsible for this to happen.
I mean, this just shows us that there doesn't seem to be much consistency. And I wonder how much discussion is there about the consequences of the trade policies? Like, are there wide-ranging policy discussions about if we do this, it will mean this? Or is a lot of it, do you think, just kind of a gut reaction and the policy follows from the president?
Well, I think of a lot of what the president does is gut reaction, but we have seen in his administration that his former top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, he quit over this. He said, this is anathema to what I believe in and what will work, and I'm quitting over this sanctions bill. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, sent a letter to the president saying this is not Republican economic policy. Now, of course, very few Republicans have stood up and said this is a wrong policy and we're going to oppose it. But for the most part, you know that the Republican establishment, the Wall Street Journal, for example, if you look at their editorial pages,
right,
almost every day decries this kind of protectionist foreign policy, which is so, and as I say, anathema to what the Wall Street Journal has been talking about for forever.
I'm interested in whether you think Gina Haspel will end up running the CIA once the vote gets taken up in the Senate for confirmation, Ken.
It's a fascinating debate because you know, if you look at all the people, former FBI, I'm sorry, CIA directors of both parties, Democratic and Republican administrations, they say she is the most qualified CIA director ever, having spent so many decades at the agency. She knows the inner workings of it. She'd be perfect. At the same time, she, of course, as we know, and as John McCain has made clear, that some of her, the opposition to her, say that she's unacceptable, given the fact that she has not denounced the previous instances of torture, of interrogation methods directed against suspected terrorists regarding, like, a war, as I say, with waterboarding, mm-hmm, with this secret camp in Thailand. And John McCain, you know, says, look, I would definitely vote against her. But at the same time, John McCain's best friend in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, shortly after McCain said what he said, I'm voting for her. Susan Collins, a moderate from Maine, Republican from Maine, who was thought to be a questionable vote, said she'll do it. Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator up for re-election in West Virginia, said he'll vote for her. So the only Republican I see voting no right now is Rand Paul.
Yeah.
And given what Rand Paul has done in the past, you know, he often says, I'm voting no against a Trump administration official,
and then somehow miraculously votes for it. Yeah, that's right.
So I think, you know, something, I think it's a controversial nomination. I think she gets, it passes. Of course, right now it's 50-49 with John McCain unlikely to vote. 50 Republicans, 49 Democrats. Anytime you pick up another Democrat or two, it increases the chances of her confirmation. I suspect that she does get confirmed.
There was a lot of close observation of the exchange between Gina Haspel and Senator Kamala Harris from California, who was asking, she was really pressing Haspel about her moral compass. And I saw an editorial headline that said, Harris is the Obama with bite. Now, I think it's pretty clear that Kamala Harris has some higher ambition. But
I agree.
But soon? What do you think of her political profile? Let me ask it like that.
Well, let me just say one thing. Of course, we remember Barack Obama was elected to the Senate in 2004, and shortly after was running for president. So,
right.
So I mean, you don't have to be in the Senate. Like Joe Biden, I think, was in the Senate for 343 years before he ran for president,
uh-huh,
and that's not the way it works anymore because more and more people are impatient. I think she's doing exactly what she should be doing. She's asking tough questions, unlike her fellow Democrat in the Senate, Dianne Feinstein, who was gone out of her way to work and accommodate Republicans and work with Republicans. Kamala Harris is aggressive. She's a former state attorney general. She knows, and she asked very serious questions about to Haspel about, well, what did you, you know, what did you used to, was it immoral,
right.
immoral what the CIA did regarding torture? And she said, I just answered that question. And Harris said, no, you didn't. I mean, she's not backing down on anything. I don't know. Look, I don't know what works anymore. I don't know what effect Donald Trump has on
this
country.
You've given up trying to figure that out.
Well, you know something. Well, look at North Korea. I mean, this was Little Rocket Man. This was the madman 6 months ago. We were talking about World War III,
right.
And now we're giving Donald Trump the Nobel Peace Prize because he's getting accommodations with North Korea.
A nomination doesn't mean a win, Ken. Just remember that.
I am out of the prediction business. But one more thing about McCain, which I think is very important, and which really, really disturbs me, is the Kelly Sadler comment. The special assistant to the president, who shortly after McCain said to vote no on Haspel, she said, well, it doesn't really matter what he's saying because he's dying anyway. And that was supposed to be a joke, by the way. That was supposed to be a joke. Everybody went ballistic over what Michelle Wolf, an over-the-line comedian, said at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That was, you know, treacherous and disgusting. But a White House aide says it doesn't matter, he's dying anyway. No apology from the White House. No backing down. No firing of Kelly Sadler. It's just, wow.
I have one last thing to ask you while we were talking about Democrats there. I was reading a piece in The Atlantic by Van Newkirk, who's been on the show a number of times, and he's examining what black voters want, and he made this point that I thought was interesting. In the middle of a nationwide conversation of diner visits and coal miner profiles in service of understanding people who voted for President Trump and his regime, there's been remarkably little analysis of the demographic that voted against him almost entirely. What drives and motivates black citizens to vote, and is simply being anti-Trump enough to get them out this fall? I mean, those are the questions that a Kamala Harris, a Cory Booker, Mark Warner, others are asking themselves, right, as they think about running against Trump in 2020.
Kirsten Gillibrand, absolutely. I think that that's a very, very important point, because this was in some ways the tragedy of the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016, the fact that we always talked about what do those working class whites think? What are those working class whites, how do they feel about jobs being shipped overseas, you know, and losing jobs and things like that? Nobody talked about inner cities, because Maybe they felt that, you know, that black voters were in the bag, as we always like to say about for the Democrats. So there were so many questions that we asked about the white working class, did not ask about black voters. And what we saw in 2016, that the huge African-American turnout that we saw in 2008 and 2012 did not reappear in 2016. Maybe black voters felt they were ignored. Maybe they just felt that Hillary Clinton was too busy trying to win over, you know, these white working class voters. But that's a very good point that he makes in the article. And these are questions that are not being asked, and they certainly should be asked as we're 6 months away from the midterm elections.
Ken, good to chat on a Monday, as always, and I will talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
But who?
Wow. I was confusing
Carrie.
You.
You became with Kelly Sadler.
You became,
yeah, no.
Kelly says exactly
no.
Right. I promise that's what it was.
Who am I
was
again,
Was this the
Ken?
Best show ever?
No.
Was this the best
no,
show
it
ever
wasn't.
Until just now?
No.
Until just now?
No, it wasn't.
Wasn't
no.
Oh, okay.
So Jim McGuinn's in the studio with me here from The Current. And
hi, Kelly.
I said to Ken as we started, okay, this has to be the best political junkie ever because we're in our member drive.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because he can't remember my name. But, you know, other than that. All good.
Always fascinating.
When you commit to Minnesota Public Radio, that's all you're saying
yeah,
about that.
Yeah.
When you commit to Minnesota Public Radio, you're supporting segments like the one that I do every Monday with the political junkie. How good is that? And Ken Rudin, let's see if he can remember my name when he gets to the Minnesota State Fair, is coming to the fair.
Nice.
And we've got an event. We're going to be at the fair together, doing shows. It's going to be really great. Hey, support Minnesota Public Radio, and you support what the political junkie does. MPRnews.org/donate 800-227-2811.